then you have a minimal losses. If you have a vacuum, you have a minimal losses. But they say they have a they are protected with patents. I didn't find any patents. I mean, millions of dollars, because this company has three offices, one in New York City, the other one in Germany, the other one in China, and there are plenty of people working there. Well, I must agree with Dr. Roy. Wait till they show something before you buy something, and wait before somebody who bought something says that it's worth for you to invest in and to exchange afterwards.
Yeah, well, keep in mind good old Theranos. Theranos was Elizabeth Holmes, I think. She's in jail right now. They had brilliant college professors in that company. I think good old Henry Kissinger invested in that company. It was worth billions, and it was all BS. So unfortunately, you can't let yourself, your guard down, just because people who are famous or who have had credentials. Sometimes people get to be a certain age and get worried about finances, and they sell their souls. And sometimes they just make stupid mistakes. So again, this is not a criteria that I use for success. I want to know what the underlying principles of things are, and when people start to tell you it's a proprietary secret, like they did with Theranos, like they seem to be doing with this, then I tell them, well, you peddle your own, you know, secret someplace else. So I don't know. I'm not as trusting as some people, I guess.
Okay, so that would be the points that I have prepared for tonight, but I have a bombshell, something that is it is amazing. It is not Chinese crap. Definitely not. It is good English, British technology. So I have to just go to it. SDR receiver from 1 kHz to 2 GHz. The model number is lower N, like Nancy, R like radio, S like Sierra, P like Papa, dash Sierra Tango, NRSP-ST. And it works with Android, iOS, tablets, and phones. Now, it covers almost possible in the frequency from 1 kHz to 2 GHz with no gaps. VLF, LF, MF, HF, VHF, UHF, L-band, and whatsoever. It has USB interface, Wi-Fi, and the spectrum that you could see on the waterfall is 10 megahertz. Three antenna ports, external clock, GPS, and whatsoever. Now, I'm going to skip some stuff because it's a network connected to the network. Work with tablets, phones, Android, Linux, Windows. But I'm going to go to something that is interesting. So I say in a simple word, from what I understood, and I repeat it again, from what I understood. Messenger up. You have your receiver, this one, in your house in Florida, and you can access it simultaneously from your house in Hawaii and another location in Japan and yet another one in New York, because it has multiple receivers in one receiver. You can open many receivers, and you can work independently with different frequencies of your choices from different locations at the same time. So making QSO with European Union from now is receiving from online receiver or receivers placed there in Europe, let's say in England, in London, and transmitting from New York. But you Your young grandson can walk on the Central Park in Manhattan with his undrained form and listen to the local BBC radio in London or Manchester using the same receiver. While your son prefers to check on 80 meters band propagation from Paris to London being in Singapore. Participation in context now becomes much easier, raising questions about how fair it is. And all of that is explained in the video that I have sent at the bottom of my email. The device costs $499 and is available at HRO right now. Dr. Roy.
Okay, Wesley, we're going to have to wrap this up because Brian wants to ask a question. And, you know, he's going to leave us soon, so I don't want him to feel as though, you know, we didn't think about him. You got to remember, there's a bunch of things. It only has a 10 megahertz bandwidth, which is really nice, but it means that you cannot simultaneously receive signals on 80 meters and 10 meters. And also, it depends upon the receptibility of the antenna that you have. If your antenna is kind of deaf for part of the band, then you can't operate on those particular bands. But SDRs are great. I love SDRs. This is a SDR Play product. They're a good company. It's a fine product. It's not perfect. Nothing is. But I think we should wrap this thing up soon.
Okay, thank you very much. It has three antennas to be connected to it, and you can activate many receivers independently from the same radio box. This is something interesting for me. Thank you very much. I leave the last subject, which is not on the list, to the next time, and I beg to you, Dr. Roy, thank you for giving me opportunity to talk about all of this stuff on the TechNet.
You're welcome, Wes. Thank you for your participation. Brian, I hope you're still out there, Brian.
This is KF2CC. I'm 98 years old.
Very amusing.
Yes, I do have a question. Okay. Are you ready?
Yes, I am.
Okay. When I switch from band to band to band, I notice that there are fairly consistent, I call it guard signals. And they look like, they almost like give you an indication like about where you should not go as a ham, above or below. But sometimes there are transmissions that are modulated. They're all modulated, but there are transmissions that are like in between. It just looks like vertical bars. And I just like to know exactly what that is. Is it intentional? Is it a beacon? Is it EMI, RFI?
Okay. Well, it's kind of difficult to predict what it is with just that explanation. The problem is that there's a lot more than amplitude modulation, single sideband, CW, and FM. A lot more. There's phase shift keying. There's all kinds of digital modes that operate using some variation of phase shift keying and such. They produce different envelopes if you look at PAN adapters. I can recognize AM, I could recognize single sideband, I could recognize CW, I can close to recognize frequency modulations, but again, there are a slew of different transmission modes available that amateur radio operators seldom have any experience with. So it could be anything. It could be EMI, it could be electromagnetic interference from some dirty motor, or ballast of a fluorescent light, or the ballast of a wall wart, or you know, a refrigerator motor, and it goes on and on and on. It could be some kind of transmission that you're unfamiliar with. But it could be almost anything. There are actual websites where they will show you pan adapter images of the audio envelope of different modes of transmission, if you can recognize the pattern. Some are weird enough that you can actually recognize. A lot of them are vaguely similar to each other. So it could be practically anything. I don't think God is sending us any radio transmissions.
Understood. I understand exactly what you're saying. However, if you're on SSB, okay, and then you're picking up these particular, let's say, you know, vertical, I don't want to call them lines, but vertical, just these transmissions, okay, at certain frequencies, will it just show SSB, or will reject the other ones, or on different formats, or will it allow everything that's on that frequency, regardless what mode you're in?
If you're talking about a pan adapters are mode blind. They are simply showing you frequency versus amplitude. If it's single sideband, if it's AM, if it's PW, if it's FM, if it's phase shift keying, it will show you how the amplitude is spread out on a given bandwidth of frequencies. That's all pan adapters do. There is no way to kind of blind them to modes. What happens is those modes are not decoded correctly. They're not demodulated correctly because the method that's used to demodulate a frequency-modulated signal requires different circuitry or, in the case of software-defined radios, different software operations than amplitude modulation and then single sideband. So you simply will get garbled mess if you try to decode an FM modulated signal using a single sideband demodulator.
So if I understand you correctly, if I choose a single sideband, I'll get pretty much every transmission that's on there, not alone just single sideband. Am I correct?
Yes, you will get a signal. You will not be able to extract the information correctly from it because you will be using a different method to demodulate it than it was designed to be demodulated with.
Okay. Now, you mentioned the word pan adapter. Could you just clarify that for me a little bit?
Yeah, a pan adapter is the simplest way most of us these days see the frequency envelope of a transmission. In the old days when there were analog radios, you really didn't have that. I mean, you could hook it up to a spectrum analyzer, but it was a pain in the backside and most people didn't. Now, because a lot of these things are software-defined radios, it's rather simple to manipulate the data to show it as a two-dimensional image of frequency versus amplitude. And usually below that is a pattern of how the amplitude changes over time as well. So the top image of a lot of pan adapters are frequency versus amplitude, and the lower display tends to show amplitude over time. So those are pan adapters.
Okay, now that I understand. Thank you for clarifying that. So last question, no sub-questions, but last question. How would I be able to identify on what bands these frequencies that are transmitting or are in use on a consistent 24/7 basis are?
Not 100% sure what you mean by that. I mean, theoretically, if you see them, then you know what frequency they're on. Because, again, the pan adapter has frequency versus amplitude. You go look at the high amplitude signals, and you read the frequency below it, and that's where they are. The frequency is inversely relational to the bandwidth. band length of a given frequency. If you want to know where you can find different modes being transmitted, I guess theoretically some of it is available on the Internet. Some of it is not public. If you try and find out the details of the military amateur radio service, you will hit a brick wall. They keep that to themselves. So the details of Mars usage is above our pay grade, as they say. But a lot of other modes are available. You can look them up on websites, and sometimes you can find software that decodes them. And you can play around with weather, NOAA weather maps are very similar to facsimile transmissions, faxes and such. So, a lot of it's available on the Internet, but a little bit of it is kept secret.
Okay, very well. Points well taken. Thank you very much, Roy. I appreciate the information. I'll look into it. It's kind of interesting to me. I like to know what these transmissions are. But thank you very much, and now I relinquish myself to the frequency.
Okay, very good. I mean, if you ever, there's a lot of open source software to decode digital signals, the PSK32, and a whole bunch of others, and sometimes it looks like a Swiss Army knife. They have drop-down menus, and there's easily something like 70 or 80 different algorithms that are used in different flavors of phase shift keying modulation. So there's a lot of ways of transmitting information. So lately people have been investigating algorithms to kind of detect what method they're using so that you can click in the proper demodulation algorithm. But I haven't played with those software yet.
So it's a question of basically outputting the audio to your PC and then running those programs on the PC.
Yeah. For the most part, it's just a matter of, unless it's something that's more complicated. Like with digital voice, it requires the use of an encoder-decoder for voices to switch analog voices into a compressed digital form. For that, you need the actual encoder-decoder. There are some people who are kind of pirating that, but it's still somewhat patented and not easily available, but people have been known to do that. But it depends upon how complicated. For the most part, just the modulation-demodulation, if that's all that it really is, you can do that in computers with proper programming. The problem is if it introduces some hardware device like encoders or decoders. For those cases, you might need to either have the hardware device or a software emulation of the hardware device.
Okay, very well. Understood. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Brian, and thank you for participating. Well, we had fun, I hope. We learned something, I hope, and I hope you'll join us next Sunday at 8 p.m. when we try and do this all over again, but it is certainly time for Paul WS2N with the SpaceNet Report.
AC2GS WS2N. Very good on everything there, all right, Roy. And, so at least we didn't have too much of a blizzard dug out this morning. And looked at my antennas, my antenna dipoles, boy, they were really sagging, from all the, when you get that wet ice mixture, toward the end. That adds up. You put, that much moisture on a 134-foot dipole, and it really sags. Anyway, very good, Roy. Let me just send keys to see if Brian's done and you're done. And, this WS1. Okay, yeah. The SpaceNet report for the part of the TechNet. And, yeah, not all that much is new lately. A couple of topics that I didn't like to talk about is Japan. Japan has an H-3 rocket that they've been launching. This was like their third launch since they developed it. It was designed to replace the H-2A and the H-2B, which were very successful, but a lot more expensive for them to launch. This one is going to be very competitive to all these other launches that have been going on lately. And it successfully got up in the air and went into orbit. It's a satellite that's being used for communication. And they'll be doing a lot more of them, you know, because they've made it less expensive and very effective. It's part of the Artemis program. It's part of the International Space Station program. They will be launching future cargo vehicles to the space station to resupply them with this new H-3 rocket. It's a liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen rocket. So I'm glad to see that in operation. Let me drop it. And Japan's been doing good lately. They've launched a lunar lander to the moon a couple of weeks ago on the 15th of January. It was a dual launch that two lunar landers were sent to Earth orbit first, and they'll eventually get into lunar orbit. And it was launched with an American lander, which I talked about quite a bit last week. But this lander was mounted underneath that one, and it'll land probably about 20 or 30 days after Lugos does. So we'll see. We'll see how that one does. It's got a... on board. They actually call the lunar lander Resilient, and the company is iSpace Incorporated. So it's actually a private company in Japan that launched this thing. And we'll see how it does. It also has, if it lands successfully, it does have a lunar rover, a small mini rover. It looks like it's about the size of a, no bigger than a microwave. Probably smaller than that, but it's got four wheels, and it's very good because it'll be able to go a distance away from the lander, turn around and take pictures of the lander itself, which I always find impressive.
Question.
It also has a little autistic thing on board. They call it mouse, built by this guy from Sweden, and it looks like a little red house, and sometimes they do weird things like that, and the rover will put it onto the surface and back away from it and take a picture of the moon house with the Earth in the distance. That's the plan there. Anyway, we'll see. Little micro rover called Tenacious. That name is a good name for this thing. See if it works out. It won't be the whole thing won't be able to make it through the lunar night, which is 14 days. They plan on going into the night as long as the batteries last. But they do plan on lasting the whole lunar day. Lunar day is 14 days, but they plan on doing about 9 or 10 days, I believe. Any comments? WS1.
a unit uniform? Paul, this is Charlie.
Good evening, Charlie. How you doing? How are you doing tonight, Charlie? Back to you.
I'm doing fine. The wife is improving over the days. She had a knee replaced. But as far as the launch, the H-3 rocket vehicle, this is expendable. This is not like Elon Musk, you know, just, okay, let's get ready for another shot.
Yeah. But it's also liquid hydrogen, which is better for the environment. There's a ratio that they use for the amount that it could lift and the amount of energy that they put into it. And this has a very high energy rating using liquid hydrogen. The fairing could even be beefed up and made even more of a larger diameter. Give you an idea, if the Falcon 9 launches a car vehicle to the space station, which it has, I think you can get up to around 8,000 pounds with the Cygnus cargo vehicle. With this thing, they're going to go up to 12,000. 13,000 and 14,000 pounds. There's a difference there. We'll see the amount of money that they put is for each launch is going to be less. So yeah, it is expendable, but you know, economically, it's going to definitely be a competitor, not only against them but against. They'll compete against the European Space Agency as well. We'll see. Anyway, back over to you, Charlie.
They have H-3-24. They say a little bit. It's got a lot.
I heard another station in there, Charlie. But you broke up. So can you just repeat that?
I did not hear you, Paul.
Yeah, you broke up. There's another station. Let me pick up the other station and find out who that is first. Go ahead. This is WS2N.
Hi, this is Brian Calf 2CZ. I can wait.
Okay, we probably doubled that. Stand by, Brian. Back to you, Charlie. I missed what you said.
H3-24 is supposed to be have more of a payload.
Yeah, that's true. That's why it's more competitive with the other companies that are launching. But it's good to see Japan back in the game. They had some problems with the H-3s. Have to work those problems out, apparently. So we'll see. One of the missions or that they're going to launch on a regular basis is the they have something called the HTV cargo vehicle, which over the years they've put 9 of these things up, like one every year, to the International Space Station, and that was using the H2B rocket, which is now retired, or about to retire. I think we got one more launch with it. So, that you know, that's going to be a regular thing. Every probably year or so, they'll be launching new HTV cargo vehicle, which is going to be, you know, carrying a lot more load, than the old one. It also has the capability of going to the moon, so they'll be able to launch that cargo vehicle to the moon and resupply the Gateway space station when and if that thing is ever put into lunar orbit. So that's, you know, they're working on improving, not only bringing cargo back and forth to the International Space Station and eventually other commercial space stations, but they're also working on a capability of launching the same cargo vehicles by the H-3 rocket all the way to the moon. We'll see. There's probably going to be a lot of changes coming up. The government is completely out of whack right now, so who knows what's going to survive and what's not. Back to you, Charlie, and then we'll go over to Ryan.
Okay, Dysfunction is a medium lift vehicle manufactured by Mitsubishi Industries, and it's not that expensive. It's about $50 million per rocket.
Yeah, I know. That's a big difference. Even, 5 years ago, I think the Falcon was $62 million per launch. So, you know, it's a direct competitor with all of these launch vehicles. And, you know, that $62 million in 5 years, I'm sure, is a bigger number right now. Anyway, let's go over to Brian and see what questions he has before we continue on. Over to you, Brian. WS2N here.
KF2CC. All right, so here's my question for the evening. Space junk. I believe NORAD monitors it and maybe some other agencies around the world. What I want to know is how much space junk there really is and how small effects could you get on the smallest piece of debris that's trackable. And the other part of my question is, how do you know where to launch without encountering something, or is there always a chance?
Good questions, Brian. And, you know, first question, the thing that NORAD tracks is 10 centimeters, which is what? 4 inches. If it's 4 inches larger, that's one of the things that they track. I believe there's 100,000 things or pieces of something, you know, either large or very small, that NORAD is tracking, 100,000. You know, now total things, you know, there's little bolts, things like that, smaller than 10 centimeters. And they estimate that's probably, you know, you probably look at like a million things, you know, probably flying around here. It could create a lot of damage. I always told the story, this, you know, it's actually in the book, about a shuttle that had gone up. And they had gotten hit with a fleck of paint. It hit the windshield. And it put like a little thing in the windshield. There's pictures of it. Couldn't go through it. You know, that windshield's like 4 inches thick on the shuttle. But it did hit and created, you know, a little thing like you would get hit with a pebble on the highway hitting your windshield. That going in the opposite direction of the shuttle. Now, the shuttle's going 17,500 miles an hour, you know, traveling from west to east. But the fleck of paint was going the other way, from east to west. Now, how do they know it was a fleck of paint on the droplet? Because there's little molecules that were left in the windshield of the shuttle. And by analyzing it, they figured out that it was a fleck of paint, the exact kind of paint that an Israeli satellite used. So what happened was Israel launched a rocket. Now, you know, you look at the map of Israel. When they launch a rocket, which isn't that often, but when they launch a rocket, they go west. They go like toward the Mediterranean. They don't go over land. The last thing Israel wants to do is aggravate Jordan or someplace like that. one of their neighbors with a rocket going overhead. The last thing they need is if that rocket fails to come down on a very populated area. So they have to launch west, which they did. And by analyzing that paint, they knew Israel. And on top of that, their rocket is going 17,500 miles an hour. Also, the only difference is going in the opposite direction of the shuttle. So, you're looking at 34,000 miles an hour impact with this little piece of paint. So it's very dangerous up there. They do need to find a way to cut back on all this stuff. If there is an agreement among all the countries that when they launch now, let me drop it. All future launches, if there's a second or third stage that puts a satellite in space, that those stages have to have the capability of turning around and firing a thrust to deorbit. They don't have to take a couple of months to do that, but they want all the space junk, future space junk to be able to deorbit. So that should help them in the future. And there's a bunch of companies that are involved with trying to clean up the space junk that's up there. And to go to your last question about, do they have to be careful when they launch something, drop it. I think a week or two ago, the Electron rocket was supposed to be launched. The Electron rocket is a rocket built by Rocket Lab. Rocket Lab is a company that's been launching probably up to 60 or 70 launches since they started launching, I think, in 2017. And their primary launch facility, they have two of them, is located in the North Island of New Zealand. And they had a third one also in the United States that they built, and they've used a couple of times already, in Wallop Island, Virginia. That particular rocket, when they tried to launch a week or two ago, they scrubbed the mission because the path that they were going on, they knew was going to be close to or near existing hardware flying around up there. It's starting to affect, present launches, and I'm sure it will affect future launches because more and more people are launching rockets. Back to you, Brian.
Okay, very points well taken, points well taken. So if you were to stop all launches today, how many thousands or hundreds or tens of years would it take for all orbiting space junk to deorbit and clean itself up naturally? Just a guesstimate or no answer at all, just curious.
Yeah, it depends on the altitude of the satellites that we're talking about. SpaceX has the Starlinks up there, and they are launched on a regular basis. If they fail, they have little thrusters to bring things down. But, you know, your question is, what happens if these little thrusters don't work? You know, it would take, you know, in some cases, like 300 miles above the Earth, probably 3 or 4 years, you know, at least, for them to come down. And it depends on, you know, all these different factors. Is it a bright spacecraft like some of the communication satellites with big solar panels? And if it is, you know, it's going to have rarefied air hitting them, and eventually they start to slow down and deorbit. International Space Station's at 250 miles. If you shut everything down and you didn't reboost it, that would eventually come crashing down. And I would say, I don't know, probably 5 or 6 years or so, something like that. So they constantly have to reboost it. Which they, you know, they do anytime they have a chance. You know, either with a Russian spacecraft that's attached to it, or now we can also do it with Cygnus cargo vehicles. We used to do it all the time with the shuttles when we docked with the International Space Station. They would always shuttle engines to put them up at 14 miles high each time. So, you know, some of the stuff at geosynchronous altitude, that's 23,000 miles above the Earth, it's never coming down. There's not enough rarefied air to slow them down. So, yeah, they won't come. In fact, they have some graveyard. Let's say a geosynchronous satellite starts to fail or fails, you know, about, they know it's going to fail. They'll push it into that graveyard orbit, which is even higher than 23,000 miles, and, you know, just so it stays away from all the other satellites that are in that location. But they're not coming down unless, you know, in the future, you know, maybe they could develop a rocket that could go up and get it, put enough fuel to slow it down and bring it back. So some of the stuff will come down, some of it won't. India, they launched a geosynchronous satellite. I mean, this thing is like, I think it's like 8,000 pounds, a big thing. That was supposed to, you know, go into a orbit 23,000 miles above the Earth. But it failed. They wound up on a highly elliptical orbit. I mean, out to like, you know, 25,000 miles at a high point, and a low point roughly around 170 miles. So every time it makes that orbit and comes near that 170 miles above the Earth, that's low. You know, you really need to get higher than that. You got a lot of rarefied air there. Each time you come by, it's going to slow it down. I haven't gotten a report on how many years that would take, but you know, a couple of, you know, eventually that thing would deorbit and become a danger to somebody because it would be an uncontrolled deorbit. So, you know, that happens quite a bit. You might remember, I don't know how old you are, but do you remember Skylab when that went up? Let me drop it. I remember that. That was, what, 1974? And, you know, they had three manned missions that went up to it. Each one had a crew of three docked with it. You know, the first one spent, you know, a couple of weeks. The next one was 2 months. The next one was like three months. And then they came back. They had future plans of using the shuttle. The shuttle was under development, but it was nowhere near being ready. 1974 was like really early. First shuttle didn't go up until what, 81? So shuttle and the time didn't work out, and therefore they couldn't dock with it, they couldn't refuel it, they couldn't do anything, they couldn't push it to a higher orbit. So it just like started to slow down. I was being caught up in all the little molecules, and they had no idea what this, where this monster was going to come down. Skylab mass was, I think, roughly around a little less than one third of the mass of the International Space Station. International Space Station has a mass of 1 million pounds, so this would have been like a 300,000 pound thing coming down. And it did. It came down and wound up in Australia, in the Indian Ocean. And some pieces actually came down on land in Australia. So, Brian, it's a big problem. You're right. Back to you. WS to land.
Brian Cass, 2CC. All right. Well, thank you. No, much appreciated for the detailed explanation on it. And that's very, very good. Well, anyway, I'm going to be going QRT, so I want to thank everyone who participated tonight. Very, very well done, and hopefully I will be on the air next week. So this is KF2ZZ, wishing everyone a good rest of the weekend.
Very good, Brian. Thanks for staying up so late and joining us. I appreciate it. And we'll catch you next week. And have a good rest of the week. Any other comments by anybody else?
I got one.
Fine business. Back over to you, Charlie.
We could have from 1958, we could have approximately what? 400,000 satellites in space.
From 1958? I don't know the actual number. Right now, I think there's something like 6,000 operating satellites. Yeah, well, in other words, since they started launching things, I don't know about 400,000 satellites, maybe pieces. There's a lot of broken things and second stages. There's a lot of debris. Some satellites have exploded. Batteries have actually exploded, blowing things up. So I'm not sure about 400,000 launches. That's very high. It's only in recent years that we've had globally 200, close to 300 launches from Earth. Back to you, John.
My computer, that question, and it's like, wow, I'm just overwhelmed on how many satellites there could be.
Okay, that's kind of high. But yeah, I put a lot of questions in. Weird things come back. Sometimes they're right. I did a space topic recently. I wish I could remember what it was. And it came up completely wrong. I don't know. But it happens. But yeah, most of the times they're pretty good, like Wikipedia. I like that for all these space topics. You should try that. I mean, put a question or a comment or a topic, and you hit Wikipedia at the end. And in the space world, anyway, they're pretty good. I find it to be pretty reliable. Okay. I know I talked about this launch a couple of weeks ago, and I just want to bring it up again because they finally got it off the ground. The New Shepard, which normally can launch people. They launch many times, six people at a time. But this one was an unmanned launch, suborbital. And the reason it was interesting to me is because they had around seven or so NASA experiments on board, and then three commercial ones. There were 10 on board, and then it was an external one. And the idea was to launch a suborbital spacecraft. By the way, the whole thing is reusable. You know, the booster comes down, lands, reuse that one over and over again. The capsule, a spacecraft, that's reusable. It comes down with three parachutes. That spacecraft, the one with the three parachutes, had these NASA experiments on board. And what they did is, when they got to their apex, which is about 100 miles above the Earth, about 100 kilometers above the Earth, around 62 miles above the Earth, they started to spin, intentionally spin the capsule, let it rotate. And by doing that, the circumference of it eventually equaled the 1/6 gravity that you would normally experience on the moon. So NASA had these experiments in the circumference of this vehicle, and I'm sure they got all their results by now on different experiments that they need to do. Equipment that will eventually operate on the moon, then they also had one on the exterior of the vehicle, so they needed to do an experiment with something that would be actually in a vacuum. So, you know, that's a rocket that's launched by Blue Origin, owned by Jeff Bezos, but very reliable spacecraft now to be able to take up crews or in this case, different experiments. So the other thing I read about it is, in the future, if they want to duplicate the gravity on Mars, they could do that as well. Mars is 1/3 of the gravity on Earth, where the moon is 1/6. So they just would spin it just a little slower. The rotation rate to get that is 11 RPM. So, and it worked out. You know, it works out just perfect for 1/6 gravity. Any comments?
No comment. I'm just listening now.
Okay, Charlie, very good. And just one other thing I wanted. A launch called BAST, a company called BAST Space Company. This company is developing what they believe is going to be a space station. Space station is called Haven, and there's going to be a Haven 1, there's going to be a Haven 2 version, and their goal was to put this thing up this year, but due to their launch vehicle, which is the Falcon 9, and other problems with the development of this space station, it won't go up until springtime of next year. So, you know, a lot of companies are trying to develop the next space station that's going to replace the International Space Station. And this company, their goal was to get this one module up there, and you would have had a spacecraft dock with it, with a crew of two or maybe three people, and they would have stayed up there for a week, maybe two, and then they would return. It only had one docking port, so you can't stay up there permanently because you need food, you need clothes, you need stuff. And to do that, you would have had to have two docking ports. So I don't know why they didn't design it right from the start with two docking ports. One, and then another one would be up except cargo. So I think they're just pushing this, just, you know, trying to hurry up, get into space, just to say we're the first, you know, private company space station. They have long and big ambitions for the future as well. So if Haven 1 works out for their first space station, they plan on launching similar modules in the future. Instead of one, they're going to launch six separate modules, and then they plan on attaching them, you know, in line with one another to create a, you know, a lot more space. We got more astronauts on board, and we'll see. There's other companies that are working on the same problem too. Axiom has a hardware that they're developing that they plan on attaching to the International Space Station temporarily to put three or four modules together. And then when it's time to deorbit the International Space Station in 1931 or 32, these new modules built by Axiom would separate from the space station and they would become their own independent commercial space station. That's another one. The European Space Agency has one under development. Okay. And we'll see about that in the future as well. Anyway, I'm looking at the time. I don't have that much, many more topics, that's for sure. We'll see see what happens for next week. And I am concerned about all these budget cuts and how it's going to affect my Boeing. Although Boeing has the Vulcan rocket they plan on launching very shortly, they're concerned that maybe the NASA will eventually do away with the launch system ship. Part of. We'll see. You know, keep watching the news and trying to figure out, you know, what's going to happen. A lot of law cases coming up. It's all going to affect the future of the all these space programs on our end, on the United States end. The European Space Agency is still going full fast. Like I mentioned
that
before,
time complete.
China, you can't stop them, and we'll see. Any last comments before I turn it back to Roy? This is WS2N.
Well, I don't believe that Boeing or any SpaceX company will experience a budget cut.
Oh yeah. I'm sure the way it's going. The problem is they can't launch anything, well, anything new, without blowing these damn things up, you know? 2 launches ago, they had the booster supposed to be caught by that machine, by the launch complex. That went down in the Gulf of Mexico. That blew up when it hit the water. And then this last thing, the Starship thing that they launched, the boost. Delta made it back, but the whole Starship blew up. What's the point? I mean,